with the Parsha of Toldos, the formation of the beginnings of the Jewish people continues, and we have at the beginning of the Parsha the birth of Toldos Yitzchak, that is Yaakov Esav. Yaakov Esav Amurim Beparsha. And the Pasuk tells us, Perik Kafhei Pasuk Kaf Aleph, that Yitzchak davens very strenuously, Vayetar Yitzchak Lashem Lenochach Ishto. It's an unusual word for tefillah. I think it's the only time we have it in the Chumash, this word. It doesn't say Vayispalel, Vayetar. Rashi explains it's an unusually intense form of tefillah. In Rashi's words, Hirba Vehiftzir B'tefillah. He davened repeatedly and very intently. And Pasuk continues, Vayosado Hashem, Hashem, so to speak, was entreated by this, Vataha Rivka Ishta. Rivka, like many of the Imos, the Pasuk says, Ki Akorahi, she was incapable of having children. And Yitzhak needs to overcome this. And the Gemara actually discusses, and the Medrash discusses, a famous comment. Mipnei ma hayu ha'imaos ha'koros, after all, the beginnings of the Jewish people, and many of them couldn't naturally have children, certainly not after for a long, long time. Sarah, Rivka, Rocha, I mean, three out of the four. And the Medrash answers, a very striking answer, Mipnei sha'kodesh baruch hu mis'ave l'tfilasim shel tzadikim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu desire, so to speak, the tfilos of tzadikim. That means that the madrego, or the connection that could be forged and attained through those tfilos, was worth it, apparently. And that's quite a thing to say, because to be without children for that amount of time was very, very difficult. But nonetheless, the overriding concern was what they rose to through their tfilos. And that explains it according to the Medrash. This Medrash is quoted by Rabbeinu Bachya in the beginning of the Parsha. And then Rabbeinu Bachya says, I brought you the Medrash in confronting this issue of the inability of the Imos to have children. Certainly nothing happened for a long time for many of them. And now, says Rabbeinu Bachya, I would like to explain this matter al derech ha-pshat, to give, in a sense, more seicheldicker reasons. Closer, perhaps, in terms of the way we can understand events. And as we will see, although generally the pshat is ostensibly more straightforward than the drash, there are great chidushim in the words of Rabbeinu Bachya. He's coming to explain why it was that three out of the four avos did not have children for so many years. Firstly, says Rabbeinu Bachya, with regards to Sarah and Rachel, I believe there is a common theme between them. Sarah is many years without children, so is Rachel. And that is, we're looking at the interplay, in a sense, between how HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants the beginnings of those generations to look, and the decisions that people make. We know that Avram not only takes Sarah as a wife, from whom he eventually has Yitzhak, but also he takes Hagar as a wife, from whom he has Yishmael. And although Yishmael gives us a lot of trouble, there is a place for him. There's a reason why he should come from Avram. He somehow has a kind of a quasi-connection, and he plays a role, really, in the future of the Jewish people, albeit as their antagonist. But it's important that he come from Avram. Rachel. We find that Yaakov marries Rachel and Leah. The 12 Shvatim that make up the beginnings of the Jewish people do not ultimately come only from Rachel and Leah. They come from Rachel, Leah, but also Bilhah and Zilpah. It's interesting that Bilhah and Zilpah, we talk about the three fathers and the four mothers, Shalosh Arba Imos, Shalosh Avos. We don't rate Bilha and Zilpah, we don't say the six imahos. But nonetheless, there are certain people, a number of people in the Jewish people, who come from Bilha and Zilpah. They don't come from Rachel and Leah. These inclusions, which are important for higher reasons, Yishmael from Avram, Bilha and Zilpah as wives of Yaakov, when we consider that never would have happened had Sarah and Rachel born children through a natural course and in a natural time. It was specifically through the delay of Sarah that she has this idea that Avram should take Hagar. It's specifically through the delay of Rachel that she has the idea that Yaakov take Bilha, which then leads Leah to ask Yaakov to take Zilpah, and thus are the Jewish people formed. And here we come to a fascinating concept. For really, we're dealing with the interplay between higher wishes, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's wishes, his plans, and people's decisions. That is to say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants Yishmael to come from Avram, and he wants some of the Shvatim to come from Bilha and Zilpah. But those are decisions that need to be made by the people involved. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu will not make those decisions for them. But on the other hand, he will lead events so that they bring these decisions out of them. And this is very interesting. On the one hand, we say, Hakol bidei shamayim, chutz miyiras shamayim. It's not in the hands of heaven for people to decide certain things. But on the other hand, certain circumstances that precipitate or facilitate decisions are very much in the hands of heaven. Sometimes they're only in the hands of heaven. And this is a concept which is discussed actually by Moshe Feinstein in the Igros Moshe with regards to a famous episode recorded in the Gemara in Maseches Brachos and Daf Yud Amud Aleph. It tells of Rabbi Meir. And there were a certain group of thugs or criminals, Hanu Biryone, that's where the word Biryonim comes from, Hanu Biryone, to have Bishavivus Rabbi Meir. There were these terrible people who were in Rabbi Meir's neighborhood. And they were making his life a misery, Papa, Kometzar Nafshe Tuva. Now, making the rabbi's life a misery is not a modern invention. It goes back already to the times of the Mishnah. But we see the Gemara says that it reached, the Gemara doesn't elaborate in details, but extent, Rabbi Meir reached a point where he felt it was Bikuach Nefesh. If they were to be able to continue to do this, he thought it's either him or them. And therefore, he reached a point where he was considering davening that they should die. It's him or them. Now, Rabbi Meir's wife, Bruria, the famous Bruria, so she, I guess, overheard certain intense words coming from his tefillos, and she confronted him over this. And she said, why are you davening that they should die? Perhaps it's because the Pasuk says, in the end of Baruch Nafshi and Tehillim Perik Kufdalet, Yitamu Chatoi Min Haaretz. So that means David HaMelech is davening that Chatoim should cease. However, says Beruiah, Miksiv Chotim, does the Pasuk say sinners? Is the prayer that sinners should cease from the world? Chatoim Ksiv, sin should cease from the world. And she continues to explain the Pasuk, until by the time she's finished, the moral of the story is, don't daven that sinners should disappear. Daven that sin should disappear. Daven that they should do tshuva. Daven that they shouldn't sin anymore. They should become good people, nice people. That's the recommended approach. Sure enough, the Gemara says, Rabbi Meir davened, and they did tshuva. And everyone lived happily ever after. Now, we should note, before we get to our issue, that the exchange between Rabbi Meir and Bruria really needs to be understood, because it seems to be shockingly low level, in the sense that Rabbi Meir read the Pasuk, but he didn't really translate it properly, because the Pasuk says Yitamu Chatoim, and Bruria says, well, it doesn't say Chotim, it says Chatoim, so if you read it right, you'll come to my conclusion. Is that it? Rabbi Meir read it wrong. He read it as chotem. It seems just to be a question of translating the pasuk. How could Rabbi Meir look at this pasuk Yitam Chatayim and think anything other than what Bruria said? It takes Bruria to correct his pronunciation. We should know actually that the word Chatayim, although Chatayim does mean sins, plural of chait, it also can mean sinners. The same word you find, for example, in Parshas Lech Lecha, the people of Sodom are referred to. Va'anshei Sodom ro'im v'chatoim l'ashem ma'od. They were sinners. How can we know? Same word, chatoim, could either mean sins or sinners. Well, if we know a bit of dikduk, or even if we don't, we're about to find out, that if the tes of chatoim has a dogish in the middle, then it refers to people. And by the way, without wishing to overload on the dikduk, not only a dogish in the test, but also a chatafatach under the chet, then that means sinners. If it's a normal patach and there's no dogish in the test, then that's the plural of chet, that's what means sins. Okay, which is the pasuk in Tehillim? Is it people or is it sins? If you look in the pasuk, you'll see it actually has a dogish. Which means that in pure terms, Rabbi Meir's right. He read the pasuk correctly. Chatoim does not the plural of sins. It's the plural of sinners, and the pasuk is saying sinners should be removed from the world. So on a pshat level, Rabbi Meir is correct. Bruria comes in now, it seems, with something of a drasha. And really what she's saying is, true as it is that al derech ha-pshat chatoim does mean sinners, but given the fact that the pasuk doesn't say chotim, but rather says chatoim, which is also very, very similar to the word chatoim, which means sins, doesn't that tell us that the way that sinners should be removed from the world is that their sins should be removed, and then they're not sinners anymore? So it was a somewhat more nuanced exchange between Rabbi Meir and Bruria. I imagine these biryonim, when they finally did shuvah, they probably became great adherents of drushas. Okay, drushas saved their life, namely at that of Bruria. But the question which is raised by the Maharsha in the Chidushi HaGodus there in Brachos is, how is this possible? It sounds like a very good idea, daven that they should do shuvah. The problem is, how can you daven that someone should do shuvah? Shuvah is a decision that a person needs to make. And of all the things that one petitions heaven for, this is the one thing that is not in the hands of heaven to grant. Because, as we say, Hakol bidei shamayim, chutz miyiras shamayim. It's true, says Marsha, we daven regularly that we should do tshuva. We say, v'hachzireinu b'tshuva shleima lefanecha. Is that the same issue? We're asking shamayim to make our decisions for us? No. The very fact that we're davening to do tshuva means we've made the decision. But we need help. Everyone needs help. You need help for Gashmias concerns. You need help for Ruchni concerns. That's legitimate. So the fact that we're asking Hachazareini b'tshuva means we want that to be the case. We've made that decision. We're looking for help. But to daven that a third party should do tshuva, right, who doesn't seem to be making the right decisions at all, and to daven that they should stop making the wrong decisions and might start making the right decisions, that seems to be beyond the scope of what tefillah should be able to accomplish. So how exactly does it work to daven someone should do tshuva? That's the question of the Maharsha. The Maharsha concludes with the words, v'yesh li'ashev v'kal lehavin. One can answer this question, and actually it's rather easy. Which means for us, there's good news and there's bad news. The good news is, it's easy to answer this question. The bad news is, the Maharsha didn't tell us what the answer is. So, this question is asked to Rav Moshe Feinstein, and others say very similarly, that as true as it is, we say, Hakol bidei shamayim chutz miyiras shamayim, shamayim cannot make a decision for a person. But there are so many factors in life that precipitate, bring out a certain decision from that person, even though the decision will be his. Shlomo HaMelech says in Mishlei, Reish va'osher al titein li, hatrifeni lechem chuki. Don't make me poor, don't make me rich. I don't want the nisoya not of poverty and not of riches. Because if I'm poor, no, everyone understands it's wrong to steal. And even the poor person who's hungry and has nothing understands that it's wrong, but it's harder for him to make the right decision. He says, "Pen evorish vigonavti. Maybe I'll be poor and I'll steal. Maybe. I don't want to do that. And I don't want to be in that position that will make me do that. Even though when I'm in that position, it will be me making the decision. But the circumstances will be brought to bear on me and make that decision much harder to resist. Upen espa vichichashti. Maybe I'll become so successful, I'll just deny Hashem. Am I to me Hashem? As long as I was feeling the pinch of Parnassa, or at least I wasn't yet ready to retire, so I'm still davening. But as soon as I get the office with the window in the corner, so then that's it. And I don't want that to happen. So don't put me in that position." So it's very interesting. Shlomo, he's making his decisions in advance because he knows that should those situations, it may be harder for me to make the right decisions. Even if he makes the wrong decision, he and anyone else by extension makes the wrong decision, it will be them making that decision. And therefore, says Rav Moshe, we don't know why these criminals were making Rebbe Meir's life a misery. Perhaps they had nothing. Perhaps they were poor and they blamed him. Perhaps they had too much and they felt that they could do whatever they want to whoever they want. And therefore, you never know if a change in circumstance or perhaps bringing positive influences into their lives, coordinating a meeting between someone who can make a difference to them. These things happen the whole time. And all of those things are Bidei Shamayim. And that is the idea of davening that a person should do tshuva, that things should bring out the better decisions in them. There's no guarantee. Some people make the wrong decision. They're resilient. Under all circumstances, they can make the wrong decision. But Burri is saying, better to try the first way, because if it doesn't work out, I guess you can always default to plan B. It's harder to do it the other way around. So these are the very important comments of the Mefarshim with regards to that idea. And we see Rabbi Beinu Bachi is a forerunner for this concept, because he's saying that the entry of Hagar into Avram's family and the entry of Bilhah and Zilpah into Yaakov's family, that can only come about through decisions. And those decisions can only be made by Sarah or by Rachel, quite so. But certain circumstances can bring out those decisions. And it seems to me, says Rabbi Nebachia, that's why their children were delayed in order for these decisions to be made by them first. Now, Rivka does not bring anyone else into the family, which means that she needs to be understood in a somewhat different way. And Rabbi Nebachia says, and I believe this is a greater chiddush than what he has said so far. Again, remember, we're in the realms of pshat, but that doesn't mean that there are no chiddushim here. Quite to the contrary. It begins, says Rabbi Nebachia, with a promise that was given to Avram in the Bris Ben Abisarim, that's back in Parshas Lech Lecha, in Breishis Perek Tesvav, Pasuk Tesvav, where he's told, although Geri Azaracha, Be'eretz Lelohem, etc. and so forth, Ve'ata Tavo El Secha Balom, Tikaver B'Seva Tover. You, however, your life will end, Hashem talking to Avram, will end well. Meaning you'll be satisfied and good, Tikaver B'Seva Tover, in good old age. And what does this mean? Rashi comments, Bisrelo, HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Avram here, what does it mean to die in a good state? It means, number one, that Yishmael, who's giving you a lot of grief, Shesofa lachso b'tshuva, in the end he will do tshuva, before, right? You will yet live to see that. And Velo yetze Esav latarbus ra'a b'yamav, and Esav won't become the terrible person that he would become, that won't happen in your days. As we know, we first hear of Esav doing all these terrible things and he's murdering and all of that, actually on the day that Avram dies. So this is the Seva Tova of Avram. Once again, he's told that Yishmael will do tshuva and Esav won't become the terrible Esav during his lifetime. Now, I must admit, I'm not sure when Rashi says this, if he means to say that this, the contents of what means Seva Tova, was communicated to Avram. As if to say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Avram these two following pieces of information. You should know Yishmael will do tshuva, and you should know that Esav will not become a criminal in your times. It's possible. it's equally possible that he was told, Tikaveh Maseivah Tovah, everything will be okay. We, looking back, know that that means that Yishmael would do tshuva and that Esav wouldn't become Esav HaRasha yet, but not necessarily that Avram was told the content. The reason why I say this is because it turns out to be something of an irony. Avram is told that he will die in a good state, under good circumstances. And that means that he won't see Esav Yotzei Letar Basra. If he heard those words, that means this is now he's being told that Esav will be Yotzei Letar Basra, which is actually bad news right now, although it hasn't happened yet. But you have an interesting situation, so, because there's good news and bad news. The bad news is Esav will be Yotzei Letar Basra. The good news is you won't see it. So that's a kind of a bittersweet good news, because now he knows that one of his grandchildren will become a terrible Rasha, just not during his lifetime. And that's why I'm not sure if Avram actually received the content, or if maybe rather he received the news that he would pass away in a good state. But the details of which, right, to fill in exactly what that means, perhaps Rashi tells us. I'm not sure if Hashem told Avram, because that would further lead to interesting questions. For if Avram knows, that means he would then pass away from the world knowing that Esav would be Yotzei Letar Basra. But it's still called Seiva Tova because he hasn't seen it. It's further interesting just to ponder that presumably we understand that the others, even after they passed away, they're still aware of events. I mean, we ask them to intercede on our behalf. They know about what's going on, which means Avram, even if he's not in this world, he will be aware that Esav is Yotzei Letar Basra. Apparently, it's worth it or decisively different if he knows about it while he's alive or knows about it once he's already passed away. And we don't know what the difference between those two types of knowledge is. If he knows about it, he may as well still be alive, but apparently no. And furthermore, and this I think is very interesting, we say better not to be alive than to see Esav turn out to be Esav. He doesn't want to see that. Just to ponder, for every day that he wouldn't be alive and seen Esav get worse and worse, he would also see Yaakov get better and better. As much as Esav starts doing these terrible things, but Yaakov is Ishtam Yeshiva Holim. So there would seem to be a trade-off, as if to say that the bad news is Esav, but there's good news called Yaakov. Does that not compensate? Apparently no, it doesn't compensate. It's enough that he's seen Yaakov in those early years be Ishtam Yoshe V'Holim, that what he would gain by seeing more of that, or having continued Nachas, so to speak, from that, would not offset what he would lose in Agmas Nefesh from seeing Esav be the way that he is. So how do things turn out? This is forecast to Avram many, many years before any of this happens. He's 70 according to the Seder Olam at the time of the Bris Ben HaBasara. He doesn't even yet have children. He's already told about what will happen to his grandchildren. And how does it turn out in the end? Well, at the age of 15, that's when Esav becomes a criminal. And that was the time that Avram died. Because Avram is 100 when he has Yitzchak, Yitzchak is 60 when he has those children. 100 plus 60 plus 15, that's 175. Those are the years of Avram. And this tells us that although it was a bracha that he didn't see Esav become a Rasha, it meant, say Chazal, that his years were actually curtailed, which is a further chiddush. Better for his years to be curtailed than to see Esav like that. And in fact, if we take a look at the end of Chayesara, which records the lifespan of Avram, and Perek Kafhei Pasuk Zion, we'll see something very interesting. Many people's lifespans are recorded in the Torah, of course, as we know. And in Perek Kafhei Pasuk Zion, Ve'ele Yimei Shinei Chayei Avraham Ashechai, these are the years of Avram's life that he lived, Me'as Shana V'Shimim Shana V'Chemish Shinim, 175 years. Two words feature in this pasuk that do not appear in other psukim. It says, "Ve'ele yimei shnei chayei Avram." These are the years of Avram's life, asher chay, that he lived. That tells us, says the Or Chaim HaKadosh, that these were not actually the years of his life. If the years of his life were more, all the Avos were meant to live 180 years, just like Yitzchak. So 175 are not the years of Avram's life. They're the years of his life that he lived, because there were five that he didn't live. And that's because of Esav. In fact, the only other place that we have these extra words when it describes someone's life and then adds the word asher chai are with other Marim. In Bereishis Perek Hei, Pasuk Hei, right? Ve'ele yimei shnei chayei Adam, asher chai, 930 years. And as we know, Adam was meant to live 1,000 years, but he saw David HaMelech in the future, would have died at birth, but he knew what David was capable of, whatever that means. He gave David 70 years of his life, or the 70 years of David are from Adam, which then meant Adam went down from 1,000 years to 930 years, and therefore you have a similar phenomena with Adam, where it says these are the years of his life that he lived. That's you have that remez in those two places. Now, here we have our variables are the lifespan of Avram, which is meant to be 180 years, but gets curtailed because of Esav. So the Mefarshim asked the question, well, instead of curtailing Avram's years, why not just delay Esav's criminal career? Another 5 years? Let him start at 20. Except, once again, we understand that that's not an option. As if to say, Esav's path will be determined by Esav. That's chutz mi'ira shamayim. If he decides that's the way that he's going to go, nothing will stop him, nothing can stop him. So of these two variables, Esav's wickedness and Avram's life, the only negotiable one, so to speak, as far as shamayim is concerned, is Avram's life. But that means that Esav, from a certain point of view, is a ticking clock for Avram. The earlier Esav is born, the less time Avram lives. What a thing to consider. And therefore, says the Reino Bachya, I understand, al derech hapshad, that the reason why it took so long for Yitzhak and Rivka to have children was in order to allow Avram to live longer. If they would have had children soon, they were 20 years waiting for children. If they had children straight away, that's another 20 years. It's amazing to consider the factors that really are set against each other ultimately, and we don't normally think about them together. Moreover, and this just boggles the mind, Rav Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, in continuing in a sense this line, reminds us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave Yitzhak and Rivka children as a response to intense tefillah on the part of Yitzhak. Vayetar Yitzhak, Rashi says, hirba v'hiftzir b'tefillah. He's davening incessantly and intensely. And the end, Hashem is entreated by that. But now, the terrible truth is that the sooner Yitzhak's children are born, the sooner Avram will pass away. So you have a very strong natural impediment to them having children. And Rav Sonnenfeld maintains that were it not for these tefillos, Yitzhak and Rivka would not have had Yaakov and Esav that soon, because Avram still has 5 natural years to go. They would have had them at the age of 65. But Yitzhak intervenes, so to speak, and there's no question that he has no notion, as he's davening for children, what the implications are. He doesn't know that the sooner he has children, the sooner Avram will pass away. Certainly not. Even when they're born, he doesn't think that Esav, somehow, he doesn't think that Esav is such a rasha. He certainly is not aware that he could be Yotzei L'tar B'Sra at the age of 15 in a way that will kill Avram. So now you have different counter forces. You have the intense tefillah of Yitzhak, which in a sense overcomes the natural delay, the full delay, and brings it back 5 years, but then the result is things as they played out, and 5 years are taken off Avram's life. So we have these statements of the Medrash, but to kind of follow them through and see how they then interact with each other can sometimes lead to fascinating discussions and amazing possibilities. So this is Rabbeinu Bechah, again, al derech ha-pshat. Now I look back at the drash. The drash seems much easier. HaKadosh Baruch Hu mis'avel et tefilosan shel tzadikim. It's a straight line. Now, one of the major episodes, of course, at the beginning of Parshas Toldos is the sale of the Bechorah. And that takes place towards the beginning of the Parsha, and it's a difficult section. Morally, to a degree, and also cosmically. Firstly, the question of, with regards to Yaakov Avinu, it seems he held his dying, starving brother over a barrel and made him part with the Bechorah for Nezid Adoshim. I mean, that's really not the full price. Was that okay? Why was it okay? And secondly, how can one sell a birthright? Birthright is accrues to the one who was born first. Because he's born first, that's where he has certain things that are true about him. Even if he sells it, that doesn't mean that he was born second. He can't sell a historical fact. So what exactly is Esav selling? That is the question. And to deal with this section, we place ourselves in the hands of the Ksava Kabbalah, Rabbi Jacob zu Mecklenburg. And as we will see, it's always the case with him, the difference between reading a parsha and reading a parsha carefully. The Ksava Kabbalah sets out to demonstrate three things. Number one, the Bechorah itself was never even under discussion in this exchange. That's number one. It related to something else. Whatever that something else is that was kind of being discussed between Yaakov and Esav wasn't actually sold. There was no transfer. That's the second thing. And finally, says the Ksava Kabbalah, as we will see, none of this had anything to do with the pot of lentils. Now, how is that so? So, the Ksava Kabbalah explains, he prefaces. When we talk about the Bechorah, the firstborn, so he has certain rights, he has certain qualities. Those rights really can be broadly divided into two domains, right? The temporal domain, the physical domain, and the spiritual domain. Temporally, he inherits more of the estate and and those material benefits. In spiritual terms, as we know, before Matan Torah, it was the Bechor who naturally stepped up to the Avoda. He was the one of the family. Even until the Chet HaEgel, that was true for the Jewish people. Now, the difference between these is that the material aspects, they are naturally true for a Bechor. All he needs to do is to be born first, and then it by definition now, he inherits a double portion and all that goes with that. In terms of the spiritual aspect, it isn't necessarily, or doesn't have to, belong to the Bechor. In a sense, it naturally accrues to him because he's first. Right, he, in a sense, has first rights, has first refusal to the Avoda. But it's more a question of, typically, it would go to the Bechor. He can claim it for himself, if he wants. Now, that being the case, being a Bechor can't be sold. It's a historical fact. Whatever goes hand in hand with that is not for transfer. But also, we'll appreciate those temporal aspects aren't really of much interest to Yaakov. Yaakov isn't looking here to get the double inheritance from Yitzchak. On the other hand, the spiritual aspect, which is the Avoda, that's something which Yaakov is very much interested in. He's interested, it's twofold. Sur meira va'aseitu. Esav shouldn't have it because he'll violate it, and Yaakov should have it because he'll use it correctly. The question is, how do we see this? Now, the very delicate analysis here is based on the fact that sometimes you find a noun which is preceded, like the verb to noun is connected with the word es, and sometimes it isn't, to do something es, something else. It's a word that defies English translation, as we know. If you can't translate the word es. We find that the two can be connected without the word es. Yitzchak says, actually, at the end of this week's parsha, Bo achicha b'mirma, your brother came with cunning, vayikach birchasecha. He took your brachas. It doesn't say vayikach es birchasecha. Between a verb and a noun, you don't need the word es, but typically you have it, you will often have it. With regards to the bechora, with the birthright, at the beginning of the parsha, the word es features repeatedly. Yaakov says, Michra kayom es becharos chali. Pasuk says, Vayimkor es becharos ol Yaakov. And then subsequently, Vayives Esav es habechora. So what then, on closer analysis, is the difference between a noun that has the word es accompanying it or not? Says Xava Kabbalo, we know, and we discussed this briefly last week, that the word es, in a sense, certainly when contrasted with the absence of the word es, does have a meaning. It means with. It's largely in the same family as the word im, ito, it's like imo. Says the Xava Kabbalah, Yaakov is never looking for the Bechorah, it's not for sale. He's looking for Es HaBechorah. He's looking for that which typically accompanies the Bechorah. Michra Chayom Es Bechoroschali. He doesn't say Michra Chayom Bechoroscha, because the Bechorah is not for sale. Es Bechorah is what he wants. And by the way, This comes out, the contrast between the word with S before it or without comes out very strikingly in our parsha. If we take a look, as Esav counts his losses in Perek Kaf Zayin, Pasuk Lamed Vav, he realizes that he missed out on the brachas also. This pasuk is very telling. Perek Kaf Zayin, Pasuk Lamed Vav. He states, Vayomer, Hachikarashim O Yaakov. Yes, good gezocht. You called him Yaakov. How appropriate. Vayakveni zeh ha'mayim. He's already treated me twice. Es becharasi lakach, v'hine ato lakach birchasi. The two wrongs that Esav enumerates from Yaakov. Number one, he took es becharasi, and now he took birchasi. Not es birchasi, because the brachas themselves were taken by Yaakov. The Bechorah itself is never taken. Es Bechorasi. We see that contrast. And therefore, it's that which accompanies the Bechorah. That's what Yaakov is looking for. Now, even so, and thus we've established the first point, the Bechorah itself was never under discussion. It's that which accompanies. But the Avodah itself was also not sold, because even that which accompanies, what does it mean to sell it? What does Yaakov say? Let's have a look at his words. In Perek Kaf Vav, Pasuk Lamed Aleph. Vayom Yaakov, Michra Chayom es Becharos Chali. What is the meaning of those words, Michra Chayom? We translate, Michra means sell. Sell it to me. Says the Ksav HaKabbalah, that's not Hebrew. The way to say sell is not to say michra. Sale, mechira, if just for purposes of illustration, is like the word zechira. Limkor and nizkor, mechira and zechira. How do you tell a person to remember something? You don't say zichra. You say zachor. Or Zachra, if you want to use that cohortative hey at the end. Which means that if the way to tell a person to remember is Zachor or Zachra, then the way to tell a person to sell would be Machor or Machra, not Michra. So what does the word Michra mean? Now we're actually stuck. We need to translate this word. It doesn't mean sell. Rather, says Xava Kabbalah, Michra is a statement of fact. Michra, it's sold. Your Bechorah is sold to me. And what does this mean? What it means is that the term Mechira, we should know, refers to a transfer, And Yaakov isn't saying, it's an amazing, but it comes from the words. Yaakov isn't saying, I want you to sell your Bechira. But really, what he's saying is that, look at you. You come in, you're up to all sorts of things, and this is the day that Avram died, and Esav doesn't care. This is an appraisal of Esav. He comes in, what does he have to say about life? Give me some of that haliteni naman adom adom azeh. That's his contribution to the day. So Yaakov takes stock of the situation. He says to Esav, do you understand where you stand? Michra chayom es bechor aschali. As of today, your es bechor ascha, the everything which accompanies the avoda is transferred to me. Are you agreeable to that? Esav says, I don't need that. Which means that even the Mechira, it's more, Yaakov is saying, you had first refusal, but you're refusing. So default to me. Is that, do you agree? And at the time, Esav agrees. But how does it transfer? Mechira, we translate as sale. But the truth of the matter is, Mechira does not mean a sale, not purely. Mechira means a deliverance, a transfer. It doesn't have to be in response to something else. We find, for example, in Shoftim, the pasuk says, "Vayimkor Hashem es Yisrael biyad Yavin." Vayimkor Hashem sold them in, or we talk about being the deliverance. Now, that's what Yaakov is saying. Michra Chayom, with your behavior, the avoda has been delivered to me. And Esav concurs. Now what about the Nezid Adoshim? I mean, that seems to be the currency here. He wants the food, Mechra Chayom, and then he gives them the Mechor, then he gives them the Nezid Adoshim. It says Ksava Kabbalah once again, you've got to look closely at the Psukim. The less closely we look at the Psukim, the less fine-tuning we have in terms of what actually happens. You see, a major principle within Torah is that the Torah will first discuss the main, when it presents any episode, it will discuss the main theme of that episode, right, the main event, and then we'll go back for auxiliary aspects of that event. And let's give a classic example, which is major, in fact. Matan Torah. What's Matan Torah all about? About receiving the Torah. So in Parshas Yisro, it will go through coming to Sinai and then hearing Aseres HaDibros. That's it. Now, later on, that's in Parshas Yisro. At the end of Parshas Mishpatim, we are told about something else that happened during that time. The Korbanos, what's known as Bris Torah at Sinai. Moreover, according to the Medrash quoted in Rashi, this actually happened before the Aseres HaDibros. This happened on the 4th of Sivan. But it's not mentioned on the before the Aseres HaDibros because the Torah pursues the primary channel of coming to Arsina. We didn't come to Arsina to offer Korbanos. We came to Arsina to receive the Torah. Part of it, accompanying that, are those Korbanos. But the Torah sees through the discussion of presentation of Aseres HaDibros and then goes back for the Korbanos. How do we know? How can we know? Because that Parsha, that later Parsha, in the end of Mishpatim, is introduced with the word Ve'el Moshe Omar Alei El Hashem. Omar, grammatically, doesn't just mean the past. Rashi tells us in a number of places. It's the past perfect. That is to say, the translation of Omar is not, he said. Omar means he had already said. And that's what Rashi comments there. That we've already finished the Aseres HaDibros. Now, be aware, we finished, so to speak, the main topic. You should know that Hashem had already, prior to this, said, Alei El Hashem, and you had those. So the past perfect is our cue to understanding that this is something that may have already happened. We didn't interrupt for it because we're focusing on the main theme. And now, Achari HaDvarim Ha'eleh, let us go back to our perek, right, to Psukim Lamed and Lamed Aleph, and that's where Esav is saying, give me the food, and Yaakov says, Michra Chayom. That was a very significant development. He's saying, the Avoda now belongs to me, and Esav says, I don't care. Pasuk Lamed Gimel, Yaakov says, "Swear to me." He swore by Yimkor. He ratified and agreed to the transfer of Bechorah. He has no qualms. That's the main topic here. Except, let's not forget about the lentils. What happened to them? Says the Pasuk Lamed Dalet, "V'Yaakov Nosan LeEsav." Nosan does not mean, and then Yaakov gave him the food. It should have said, as it uses the Vav HaHipuch with everything else, it should have said, Vayitein Yaakov le'esav lechem nezid adoshim. But that would mean then he gave it, which means he wasn't giving him the food until he agreed to the Bechorah. That's not true. Yaakov nosan le'esav, the ikur here is not about the food. The ikur is about the Bechorah, and it sees that through. However, it doesn't end the parsha without telling us that Yaakov had already given him the food when he asked for it. He didn't hold it over him. It's the past perfect. You want the food? Here's the food. But the pasuk doesn't interrupt for that because it's a side issue. It's a side dish. The main point is the Bechorah, and therefore it sees through the Bechorah. The final pasuk brings us back earlier to the proceedings. The key word is Nosan. So it's quite amazing. This is the classic Sava Kabbalah, whereby we all see the same words. But if we see them through the eyes and attention to detail, the difference between a noun with an S, without an S, we presume translations that may not exist. Michra and Machra are not the same thing. Nosan and Vayitein are not the same thing. So the more we apply ourselves to the words and to the psukim, the more we emerge with a crystallized understanding. Now, there's a very interesting comment of the Balaturim in the beginning of Parshas Toldos, which begins, of course, to Ve'ele Toldos Yitzchak ben Avraham. Pardon me, the Balaturim is actually the end of Parshas Chayesara. For what has been discussed at the end of Chayesara are the descendants of Yishmael, all of his children, and then the pasuk says, "Vayishkenu mechavila ad Shur." This is the final pasuk of Parshas Chayesara, and they dwelt from Chavila to Shur, Asher Pnei Mitzrayim, Boach Ashura, Apnei Cholachav Nafal. Amongst all his brethren, Nafal literally means that he fell, even though Al Chapshat Nafal is another way of saying that he encamped. Else earlier it says Apnei Cholachav Yishkon. Here it says Apnei Cholachav Nafal. The Balaturim notes this. Chayesara ends with the fall of Yishmael. The Somech Le'Ve'ele told us Yitzchak. And then straight away, the next pasuk is, told us Yitzchak, Lomar, to teach us, Kishe Yipol Yishmael Ba'achris Hayomim. When Yishmael ultimately falls, the end of days, Az Yitzmach Ben David Shimi told us Yitzchak. Then will emerge told us Yitzchak with Yitzchak's descendants, that's when they will rise. So we have here a certain confrontation, and rise and fall. As Yishmael falls, then the descendants of Yitzchak will rise. It's very interesting that the final fall that precipitates the Yitzmach ben David is the fall of Yishmael. Yishmael is the antagonist, Ba'achur Sayomim, says the Balaturim, hundreds of years ago. And it's interesting because we're aware of the concept of, who are our antagonists, who are our enemies. We have the Arba Golios, and began with Bavel, and then Modai, and then Yavan, and then finally Rome, which represents Edom, and that's Esav. Somehow Yishmael isn't formally one of those Arba Golios, that he is the one who is against us. And yet, we find something interesting. The four Golios are depicted in Nebuchadnezzar's dream. And this is in Sefer Daniel, in the second parak, he has his dream. No one knows what it means. No one even knows what he dreamt. He himself said he didn't remember what he dreamt. Daniel comes in and tells him what it was. And once he tells him, he remembers it. And then he explains the whole thing. He saw this statue. It's got a head of gold and a torso of silver. And then it's got its legs and it's got its feet. And these four parts of the statue correspond to the four Golios. You are the head of gold, he says to Nebuchadnezzar. That's the first Golos, Golos Babel. And then moving downwards, you have Golos Modai, and then Yavan. The feet are Edom, are the final Golos. And what's interesting about the feet of this statue is that the pasuk says in Nebuchadnezzar's dream that the toes were made of different materials. Some of them were made of metal and some of them were made of clay. Reb Chaim Vital, the primary disciple of the Arizal, explains that what that means is that the final stages, right, the bottom of the feet of Edom, actually will divide into two. The metal and the clay correspond, says Reb Chaim Vital, to the forces of Esav and of Yishmael. It's they combine together. And therefore there's a certain duality towards the end of the final Golus. It's in the toes. And moreover, we find in the end of this week's Parsha that it's actually the final pasuk of the Parsha. After everything that happens, what's the last thing we read? Esav marries the daughter of Yishmael. And the Vilna Gaon explains that that marriage between Esav and Yishmael corresponds to a merging or a pooling of forces between Esav and Yishmael. And it's very interesting for us to see how that's kind of played out, in the sense that there are certain things that Esav gets from Yishmael. There are certain things that Yishmael gets from Esav. You have the fuel and the fundamentalism of Yishmael, which is only fully activated when it's organized by Esav, whether that's the former Soviet Union or the other expressions of Esav closer to our times. And this is what the Jewish people need to contend with the toes of metal and of clay, as they form part of the same foot. But it's interesting that Yishmael is predicted as falling into the descendants of Yitzhak. I mean, Yitzhak here represents the Jewish people, but he's not the only father that represents the Jewish people. But somehow, the antidote or the response to Yishmael comes from Yitzhak specifically. And what is it about Yitzhak? So if we refer to another fascinating comment of the Balat Urim, when Yishmael is originally given his name, and this is in Perek Tet Zayin, Pasuk Yud Aleph. This is when Hagar is told to name Yishmael. This is the Malach, which the section that we discussed 2 or 3 weeks ago. You'll then have a child. And you call him Yishmael. Now, very often what the Balat Urim does is that he references for us, if you have a word that only appears like very few times in the Tanakh, the Balat Urim will list them out for you and then explain them. How they're somehow connected, even though they feature in different contexts. The Malach says, you will have a child, Vikaros Shemo Yishmael. Says Balat Urim, Dalet B'Mesorah. There are 4 times the word Vikaros features in Tanakh. I mean, this is a different way of learning Tanakh altogether. And this is before there's anything other than the people looking. Hacha, firstly, here, Vikaros Shemo Yishmael. Secondly, V'idach, V'karos eschem hara'a ba'achris hayomim, which is later on in the Chumash, v'yelech. Evil will before you, ba'achris hayomim. The third is a pasuk in Yeshaya, Perek Zayin, V'karos eshemo Immanuel, which is the child that will be born then. And the fourth is also from Yeshaya, V'karos Yeshua chomosayich, and you will call salvation for your walls. So we have the 4 vikaroses, the naming of Yishmael, the difficulties at Achris Hayomim, Imanu Kael, right, that calling out Hashem is with us, leads to salvation of the wolves. And so the Mefarshim explain that this is really what connects them. Yishmael is trouble, and he's already at that stage, it's vikaros, trouble for Achris Hayomim. The response of the Karos Eschem Hara of Yishmael is the Karos Shemo Emmanuel, that we need to reconnect for Hashem to be with us, and that will lead us to the Karos Yeshua HaMosayich. Yitzchak, of all of the Avos, and each one has their quality, but Yitzchak is the Amud HaAvodah. He's the one that represents Tfilah, and he's the one that represents Emunah more than anything else. I mean, he was prepared to offer himself up as he's the Ola Tmima on the Akedah. In a sense, the role model The inspiration to counter Yishmael is Yitzchak, because the call towards the Jewish people at this time is that they need to be more Yitzchak than the others are Yishmael. They need to ensure, we need to ensure that our emuna in what's right is stronger in their emuna in what's wrong. Because they see Hatzlacha. And I used to think the chutzpah was a Jewish invention. Maybe it is, but it's been taken over. Everything's been taken over, including, right? They have no sense of what not to ask for. And it's rewarded. They don't apologize for what they believe in, and it's accepted. And the Beis Halevi, when he left the Yeshiva of Voloshin and became the Rav in Slutsk, so there was terrible trouble with the Maskilim there, it was mamish in the heartland there. And they convened a meeting, the new Rav, and they no one knew what to do, so they're wondering what will the Beis Halevi, what will he suggest. So the Beis Halevi says, you know, they're having such success, it seems the MS is prevailing. So they were shocked. These are the Maskilim, said Rebbe, the Emes is prevailing, they're Apikorsim. The Beis Halevi said, and remember, he's the first of the Soloveitchiks, they are Apikorsim, but they're Emestik Apikorsim. So they've got a lot of drive. We're right, but we've got to be Emestiker right, and more Emestiker right than they are. That's how we'll prevail. Of course, we understand the point is not to dismiss other means, right? We need to do what we need to do, but not to forget amongst all of that to reconnect, essentially. And it's possible that part of their role is to force us really to confront what we need to be believing in and ensure that we do. And if we began by discussing HaKadosh Baruch Hu mis'avel tevilos neshet tzadikim, no individual amongst us is on the madrega of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, but the Jewish people collectively, they are the legacy of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. HaKadosh Baruch Hu certainly wants the tefillah of the Jewish people. So this should be a point of chizuk for us amongst everything else. I mean, we hear the news and we're wondering what we can do. And here's an answer for us. In Mitzvah Hashem, we should look forward, Bekarov, to the final Bekarov, Yeshua HaMashiach, Meher B'Yameinu.